the town of Cheektowaga, which is just outside the city of Buffalo, and a couple of other places as well. The fear at this point is there are more deaths that haven't been confirmed just yet. And when you think of that, your heart breaks for these families because in some cases, some of these people were found inside cars, and because of the cold and because of the snow drifts, they were buried. In some cases, that's possible, but the idea that these people were helpless is something that is just gut-wrenching.
Are you hearing stories of people inside their homes without heat at this point?
Absolutely. There are still, this morning, more than 10,000 National Grid customers in the city of Buffalo without power. And those people have been without power, in some cases, for days now. Grocery stores aren't open in the city of Buffalo right now, and they probably won't open again until tomorrow. The airport is closed until tomorrow, so people aren't even coming to or from, even for holiday travel. The city was at a standstill for the last 3 days.
Ed Dranch of WKBW in Buffalo, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Most of this country faced unusual cold the last few days. Airlines canceled thousands of flights. More than 1,000 have been scrubbed today alone. Many more are delayed, just as you or someone like you may be traveling for the holidays. So what does that mean? David Slotnick is the senior aviation business reporter with the travel site The Points Guy. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So this happens from time to time, but how bad is it this time?
Well, this time it was about as bad as it gets. It was a situation where the storm was just really unprecedented in its size and its longevity, and it came during the busiest travel days of the year. It really couldn't have been more of a perfect storm. Okay. Really not a scenario.
No pun intended, I guess. But we should emphasize. But go on, please.
Yeah, I mean, it really was as bad as it gets. It's the worst scenario they're looking at, and it all came true this weekend.
Well, let's talk about the aftermath. I can think of past travel times when I am at an airport where the sun has come out, where the weather is cleared, and my plane is still not there because the plane is out of position, the crew is out of position. How out of position are airlines after the last several days?
They're pretty out of position. At this point, the travel system is more or less stabilized. Things aren't as bad as they were, Buffalo being the exception, where the airport is closed until tomorrow. But the airlines are really stuck trying to get everybody back into position. During a normal storm like this, or a hurricane or something, the expectation would be to be able to recover within a day or two. In this case, just the storm was so widespread and so long-lasting that it wasn't possible. They had planes that were just stranded around the country. Crew were completely overwhelmed. Flight attendants and pilots couldn't get through to their dispatchers and their schedulers. Now the airlines are stuck trying to recover from that, trying to get everybody back in place just as people are trying to get where they need to go.
Do you have friends and family who know what you do for a living and ask you if they should go ahead with their holiday travel plans?
Oh, constantly. I myself went through with my travel plans. I got lucky on the way down. Who knows what's going to happen on the way back?
Without getting too personal, where are you?
I'm in Florida, so I managed to escape the worst of it.
That's great. And so how many days do you have until your return flight, and do you think things will be better by then?
Well, we're supposed to go back today, and I'm not sure. As of right now, things are looking good, but more than 1,500 flights, or about 1,500 flights have been canceled around the country. That's much better than the last few days, but, you know, it's still an ongoing problem.
The Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg warned airlines over the summer that they would face consequences if they did not improve operations, did not improve customer service. Are they finding ways to manage a situation like this better than maybe 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
You know, for the most part, they are. There's a situation where, you know, with the changing dynamics of the pandemic, there were a lot of airlines rather who were understaffed and they were really flying more than they could handle. And that was going on really through the summer. Since then, the situation's gotten better. The airlines have been more disciplined about the flights they're planning. They've been better about staffing up. And they've really done that with this kind of scenario in mind. The thing was, this was just so much worse than normal.
I wonder what flying might be like in the new year, considering that a lot of businesses seem to be bracing for an economic slowdown. They're starting to cut costs. I would imagine that airlines are thinking about whether they can keep up full staffing or not.
Yeah, I mean, the airlines had so much trouble staffing back up that I think they're going to be very eager to keep as many people as possible for as long as possible. Right now, they say that they're not expecting the worst. I spoke with the United Airlines CEO a couple weeks ago. He said that they're planning for a very small recession, but don't expect really any impact on that except for possibly their yields or their margins. So, you know, ideally it's going to be a situation where they can keep staff and just try and have some of that stability that they've lost over the last few years.
Well, David Slotnick, safe travels to you if, in fact, you do get to travel today.
Much appreciated. Thanks, Steve.
He's a senior aviation business reporter for The Points Guy. 10 months into Russia's war with Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin says he wants to negotiate an end to the conflict. Or does he? The statement came as air raid sirens were reported across Ukraine, and in the Ukrainian city of Kherson, at least 10 people were reported dead from a rocket attack on a market on Saturday. NPR's Charles Maines is covering the story from Moscow. Hey there, Charles.
Morning.
Let's listen to the words. What exactly did Putin say, and how did he say it?
Yeah, well, context here, of course, is important. You know, Russia has repeatedly said it's open to negotiations. The catch, it's provided they're on Russia's terms. And that really was at the core of Putin's message in an interview on state television Sunday. Let's listen. So here Putin says he's ready to discuss some acceptable outcomes in Ukraine, but insists that it's Kyiv and the West who've refused to negotiate. And again, more context, Putin's argument for a while now has been that the fighting would have ended on Russians' terms if it weren't for Western military aid to Ukraine. Putin went on to say the West was trying to tear apart historical Russia, which in his mind includes Ukraine, and that Russia had no choice but to defend its citizens. So certainly he's coming at this with his own unique perspective.
Well, let's explore that perspective a little bit more. You've indicated that he's always said he wants peace on Russia's terms. Is he reflecting at all the reality that Russia's military has done so badly, has suffered such enormous casualties, and while they have taken some territory in Ukraine, they've also lost some?
Yeah, you know, to a degree, although not to a point that's acceptable to Ukraine. You know, early on, the Kremlin wanted regime change, a pro-Russian government in Kyiv. That was behind Putin's calls for denazification, if you remember, this part of this kind of false claim that Ukraine was somehow overrun with fascists and needed to be neutralized. But as Ukrainian forces pushed Russian troops back from Kyiv and then other portions of the country, Moscow's demands have shifted to really asking that Kyiv recognize Russia's right to Ukrainian lands it has seized. Specifically, this is four regions of Ukraine that Russia annexed in September in a move that was condemned internationally as illegal. But there's a problem here as well. You know, Russian forces can't seem to hold the territory. And so if you're Ukraine and you keep liberating your own country, why would you sign away anything? That said, there is a debate, particularly in the West, over whether it's realistic for Ukraine to reach its stated objective, the complete expulsion of Russian troops from Ukraine, including from Crimea, which Russia annexed back in 2014.
Would you give us an idea of the significance of something else that Putin said, something that Russian media were shut down at one point if they used the word, and now Putin is using the word war for the special military operation? What's going on?
Yeah, you know, ever since the beginning of the conflict, there's been this strange semantic game going on here. You know, the Kremlin, as you note, banned the use of the word war by the media, even shutting down some media over it, and insisted it was conducting a special military operation in Ukraine. And the reason for that term is this. It implied the military campaign was limited in scope, with limited sacrifice for the Russian people. And yet here we are 10 months later, and Putin finally publicly said Russia wanted, quote, the war to end soon. Now, like his negotiation offer, it came with charges the West was trying to prolong the conflict. But the use of the word itself is significant in that it was a small nod to growing discomfort at home over a war that has gone on far longer than promised or planned, and at enormous cost not only to Ukrainians, but Russians as well.
And NPR's Charles Maines, listening to what Putin said and also to what it may mean. Charles, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, it's 8:19. The FBI hate crime data for last year is so flawed and incomplete that experts are warning it could mask a real trend, a continuing and troubling rise in hate incidents and violence across the country. That story is still to come this hour on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Foresters are saving some trees for the future.
We're in the lumber business. We're in the millwork business. We need these trees for our mill, but we need them for a seed source more. So we just have to be patient.
I'm Kimberly Adams, Lumber for Later, next time on Marketplace.
You can hear Marketplace tonight at 6:30, right after All Things Considered with Brady Carlson on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. Dedicated to protecting the state's lands, waters, and wildlife, and connecting all people with nature in Wisconsin. More is at wisconservation.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Village of Pleasant Prairie invites the community to participate in the 12th Night event on January 6, 2023 at Prairie Springs Park with the traditional holiday tree burning bonfire. Festivities kick off at 5:30 p.m. Bonfire begins at 6:15 p.m.
Southwestern Wisconsin starting off the day dry across the rest of the state with daytime highs in the upper teens to low 20s. Temperatures expected to be bitterly cold overnight with wind chills near 15 below in the north. Wednesday, a warm front begins to move in with temperatures reaching the 30s across the state. The southern portion of the state could see temperatures reach 50 degrees by Thursday. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure the future of Africa's wildlife and wild lands. Learn more at awf.org. And from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Is it possible that you can tell time when you're asleep? In this part of our series, Finding Time, NPR's Will Stone begins with his own experience.
Sometimes there's this thing that happens to me. It almost feels like a superpower. Sleep researcher Dr. Robert Stickold says I'm not the only one.
Just hundreds and thousands of people who all say, you know what, I wake up a minute before my alarm clock goes off.
Stickold is a cognitive neuroscientist at Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center.
And if I have to change my alarm clock because, like, I have a flight to catch and I got to get up early, I wake up a minute before that.
So is this actually a thing?
I can assure you that all of us sleep researchers say, balderdash, that's impossible.
Of course, Stickold says humans have an elegant and intricate system of internal clocks that help our bodies keep time. They regulate our circadian rhythms throughout the 24-hour cycle, and this affects when we go to bed and wake up. Except Stickold says that doesn't totally explain what we're talking about here.
So it's a true scientific mystery.
A mystery that other sleep scientists are familiar with, including Phil Gehrman at the University of Pennsylvania.
I hear this all the time.
In his experience, he says it seems to happen when people know there's something they have to get up for.
I think that anxiety about being late is kind of contributing to this.
Gehrman says a lot of mornings he wakes up before his alarm, maybe not right before, but in the general vicinity. That he attributes to his lifestyle, though.
Because I do tend to get a decent number of hours of sleep, and I think I'm just fortunate that the timing of my rhythm syncs up with the schedule that I need to keep.
But this question, why is it that some people can wake up at a precise time before their alarm, did remind him of an intriguing study published in Nature more than 20 years ago from a group in Germany.
I'm Jan Bohm, and I'm a professor for behavioral neuroscience at the University of Tübingen, Germany.
Born says his team was interested in how expecting something to happen influences what's known as the HPA axis. This is a complex system in our bodies that deals with our response to stress and involves the hypothalamus, which is in the brain, the pituitary gland right beneath it, and the adrenal glands sitting over our kidneys. Born says they knew there was an increase in HPA activity, meaning hormones were released, as your body prepares to wake up from sleep.
We decided to just to try out. It came out as hypothesized.
Here's what they did. They found 15 people who'd normally wake up around 7, 7:30. They put them in a sleep lab and took blood samples all night. There were different groups. One was told they'd get up at 6 a.m., another 9 a.m., but was then unexpectedly woken up at 6. Born says there was a clear difference. The group who expected to wake up at 6 had a notable rise in this hormone starting about 5 a.m., as if their bodies knew they had to get up soon.
And this is a good adaptive preparatory response of the organism, that because then you have kind of enough energies to cope with getting up, and you can make it until you have your first coffee, maybe.
Bourne says the results raise big questions. How did the participants keep track of time so well while sleeping? After all, this wasn't when they typically got up. But Bourne says the results aren't entirely foreign to those who work in sleep research.
It is well known that there is a kind of mechanism in the brain that you can use by volition to influence your body, your brain, while it is sleeping.
For example, he says hypnotic suggestion can help make someone sleep more deeply. Even so, Bourne says he can only speculate as to what exactly is going on here.
Very amazing, amazing phenomenon.
Over the years, some scientists have tried to see just how real this phenomenon actually is, with mixed results. One small study found that over two nights, people were able to wake up within 20 minutes of the target more than half of the time. The two subjects who did the best were then followed for another week, but their accuracy plummeted. Another small experiment let people choose when they'd get up. About half of the time, the wake-ups were within 7 minutes of the target. Some research has found when you simply ask people, more than 50% believe they can wake up before their alarm. But Dr. Stickold at Harvard says the superpower that I and others think we possess may actually not be so reliable.
Maybe we'll find out that, like a lot of things that we think we do all the time, we only do it once in a while.
Still, he thinks there is something here, but that doesn't mean he plans on ditching his alarm clock anytime soon. Will Stone, NPR News.
When the words in a song hit you the right way, they stay with you. So our colleagues at NPR Music collected lyrics they could not shake in 2022.
Hi, my name is Lars Gottrich. I'm a producer for NPR Music, and this is the band Straw Man Army. The song is Humankind. Straw Man Army comes out of the New York hardcore and punk scene. The very first lyric is, humankind can be hard to find.
Humankind can be hard to find. People who look at you right in the eyes.
You know, we have seen what humanity has wrought in the face of racial reckoning, presidential elections, COVID mandates, breaking COVID mandates. It's enough to make you think, are we actually looking out for each other? And the band goes on to say that they're talking about humankind as a species that carries a spiritual debt. And so when you're carrying that weight, it can be hard to just kind of look over to your neighbor and wonder how they're doing. And, you know, I'll be honest, it's a bleak song, but it's a bearing witness to what the last couple of years have done to humankind, and how it can feel like, as I say later on in the song, that we are oarsmen for a crooked ship, clinging for life to the side of it. But then, I come back to that first line. Humankind can be hard to find. And the can is doing a lot of work there. It's saying humankind can be hard to find, but it's not saying that it's impossible. And that's what I have clung to. That's why this lyric has been my favorite of the year.
Humankind by the band Straw Man Army. Lars Gottrich curates the Vikings Choice playlist at NPR Music. This is NPR News.
If you serve decades in prison for a crime you didn't commit, what does the state owe you? And how would you spend your compensation?
I treated myself to jumping out of a plane.
Oh my, you went skydiving?
Yes.
Seriously?
I did that twice.
I'm Ari Shapiro. What comes after exoneration? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news with Brady Carlson from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. It's 1 minute before 8:30. NPR has national news and WPR with state news, both on the way next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. At least 14 deaths are being reported in western New York after a blizzard hit the Buffalo area. The snow off Lake Erie is being measured in the feet. Thousands of homes and businesses lost power in the heavy snow, strong winds, and extreme cold. Authorities say some of those who died became stranded in their vehicles. Byron Brown is Buffalo's mayor.
There are people that have been without power since Friday. Temperatures have dipped to, in some cases, minus 22 degrees below zero with the wind chill. We've been able to help National Grid cut the power outages in Buffalo in half.
Brown was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. New York's Governor Kathy Hochul describes the storm as once in a lifetime. She says this blizzard tops the blizzard of 1977 in Buffalo. Duke Energy says it's been conducting rolling blackouts in the Carolinas to conserve power amid the extreme cold. Jeff Brooks is a spokesman for the utility.
The idea with these planned temporary outages is when we reach a point where we no longer have enough electricity to meet all the needs customers have, and in this case, we didn't have any from the other regions either because all the utilities in the Southeast are dealing with this.
Wind chills in western North Carolina were well below zero on Christmas Eve. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. People ages 65 and up were first in line to get the COVID-19 vaccine, but only about 42% have received their updated booster shots. That's far off from the state health department's goal of at least 80% getting their bivalent boosters. Dr. James Conway is the medical director of the UW Health Immunization Program. He says older people have weaker immune systems and largely depend on the goodwill of others getting vaccinated. They are especially vulnerable as people gather indoors during the winter and travel.
Fine, but if you're going to go see grandma, you need to get yourself vaccinated because you don't want to be the one that inadvertently brings virus to grandma and infects her and causes her ultimate demise.
According to the state health department, about 95% of the people who died from COVID-19 in Wisconsin last month were more than 60 years old. We Energy says homeowners can turn their thermostats back up. This after asking customers to lower their home's indoor temperatures to 62 degrees on December 23rd. This happened following what the company calls a, quote, significant equipment failure. That failure involved a pipeline delivering natural gas. The equipment issue, combined with maximum usage because of extremely cold outside temperatures, resulted in the company asking homeowners to lower their thermostats immediately. We Energy said the following day that customers could raise their home temperatures back to normal and that they now have enough natural gas to keep homes heated. Light snow is expected in southern Wisconsin today and then dry across the rest of the state. Daytime highs in the upper teens to low 20s. Another bitterly cold night is in store for Wisconsin with wind chills expected to hit 15 below in the north. Isolated frozen sleet and snow are expected near Wausau late Tuesday as well. A warm front pushes through much of Wisconsin Wednesday with daytime highs reaching the mid-30s up north and upper 30s in the south. On Thursday, temperatures continue to rise across Wisconsin, with daytime highs reaching the low 40s in the north and low 50s in the south. Rain is likely as well. Friday, more rain and warm temperatures expected across the state, with daytime highs reaching the low 40s in the north and upper 40s in the south. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Noom, a personalized program based in psychology to help people understand their motivations, change their habits, and lead healthier lives. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Happy Boxing Day to those who celebrate. People tracking hate crimes say they're increasing in this country. The FBI's most recent statistics could give the idea that they're not. So which impression is right? Here's NPR's Sandhya Dirks.
Shock and disbelief. That's what Cynthia Miller Idris felt when she looked at the FBI's 2021 hate crime numbers. Miller Idris knows something about the subject. She's a professor studying violent extremism at American University.
The first thing I noticed is the numbers went down. That's not consistent with everything that we're hearing and seeing.
Data coming out of cities and from advocacy groups have all been showing a continued rise in hate crimes, from anti-Semitic to anti-Black hate and anti-LGBTQ to anti-Asian hate, but not in the FBI numbers.
And then I see this almost like a little side note, but it's only 63% of jurisdictions reporting.
Most of Florida and California didn't report. There's no data from America's three largest cities, Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago.
Every city I typed in, no data there.
It's not the FBI's fault that these cities failed to share hate crime data, but Miller Idris says the report shouldn't have been published at all.
I think it's unconscionable to release it and to call it national data because it's insulting to victims who don't see their own experiences reflected.
The FBI warned ahead of time that the 2021 hate crime data was going to be flawed. The reason has to do with data collection standards. The Bureau changed to a new system. The change didn't just happen overnight. Local law enforcement agencies have had 5 years of FBI training and over $100 million to prepare. The Southern Poverty Law Center's Michael Lieberman says the new standards should be a good thing, a more robust way to measure crime.
And still, 7,000 agencies this year did not report any data to the FBI.
Lieberman says this year compounds a long-standing problem, the underreporting and undercounting of hate crimes. Sometimes it happens because victims don't come forward. Often, communities most likely to be the targets of hate are also the folks who have the reasons not to trust police. And Lieberman says police don't always correctly label or investigate hate crimes.
If you're a city like Miami and you reported zero numerous times in the last decade, you are not giving your community any faith that you are ready and willing and able to respond to hate violence.
Right now, reporting hate crime numbers to the FBI is voluntary. The Southern Poverty Law Center, alongside numerous civil rights groups, are calling for hate crime reporting to be mandatory, credible, and tied to federal funding. Because it's about more than just the data.
The big story here is that we are not reporting the plight of victims and their communities.
That's Brian Levin. He runs the Center for Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino, which collects hate crime data from large police departments. He says these days there are more entryways into hate than ever before, and not just online.
Because we don't have the hierarchical, yet more limited hate groups that we used to see, like the Klan. Now we have a pick and choose buffet.
Even in the last few weeks and months, we've seen a normalizing of hate.
That's Manjusha Kulkarni with Stop AAPI Hate.
Kanye West has freely made anti-Semitic remarks. Former President Trump continues to use anti-Asian rhetoric.
Kulkarni says the answer isn't really about police. It's education, teaching kids about other cultures, about history and racism and bigotry, exactly what's under attack in many Republican-led states right now.
It's precisely because awareness has been raised and because news outlets are focusing on anti-Asian hate, anti-Semitic remarks, anti-Black actions, that these forces are there to silence it.
Kulkarni says accurately reporting hate crimes today is just as important as telling the truth about the history of hate. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
This country's home buying frenzy is really, definitely over. Home sales have fallen for 10 straight months. It's the longest streak of declining sales in more than two decades. NPR's Arzu Rezvani spoke with buyers and sellers.
34-year-old Evan Paul went into 2022 thinking this would be the year his family would finally buy a home.
We just kind of got to that place in our lives where we were financially very stable. We wanted to start having kids, and we wanted to just kind of settle down.
Paul and his wife, who both work in the biotech industry, did end up having a baby, a little girl, just a couple of weeks ago. But they never did move up and out of their two-bedroom condo. Initially, it was because of high home prices in their city of Boston. A year ago, low interest rates unleashed a home buying frenzy, and they were outbid every time.
There'd be, you know, two dozen other offers, and they'd all be $100,000 they were asking.
Then the Fed started raising interest rates, and after a few months, it was the high mortgage rates that priced the Pauls out again.
Yeah, eventually the anxiety just caught up to me, and we just decided to call it quits and hold off.
There are far fewer buyers in the marketplace.
That's Lawrence Yoon, chief economist for the National Association of Realtors. He says while buyers like the Pauls have been pulling back, sellers are also reluctant to jump into the market because they'd also be slammed by a pricey mortgage.
To re-enter the market today, they would have to give up that 3% and possibly get the new loan at much higher interest rates.
And that right there is what's contributing to something of a freeze in the housing market, says Susan Horowitz, a New Jersey-based real estate agent.
The sellers aren't putting their houses on the market, and the buyers that are out there, certainly the power of their dollar has changed with rising interest rates. So there is a little bit of a standoff.
Surprisingly, that standoff hasn't had much of an impact on prices. Home prices have remained high despite the slump in sales activity.
Because there's no inventory. So anything that comes on the market is the one salmon running upstream, and every bear has just woken up from hibernation.
But even that trend is beginning to crack in some markets. It's been slow going lately at agent Elijah Shin's open house in Los Angeles, where he sweeps the sidewalk waiting for the occasional visitor to swing by.
Well, I think we're in the transition again, and of course no one knows the future, but we do look like we need a market correction here and there. It was a few crazy years.
He gives a thorough tour to anyone who comes through.
And this can be a closet, and this is the entire master suite.
And connects with prospective buyers however he can.
You want a flyer? We'll be here Tuesday and Thursday if you want to.
But things are just different now.
Well, a year ago, this property would have already been sold. I think this home will sell too. It's just going to take a little bit longer.
Or a lot longer. This little starter home in one of the more coveted neighborhoods of Hollywood first went on the market back in August. 4 months later, it's still waiting for an offer. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for joining us for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42 this Monday morning. Still to come this hour, schools across the country are being bombarded with false reports of shooters and other types of violence. These swatting hoaxes can have lasting consequences for local police and other members of the community. That story is still to come this hour here on Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listener support makes Wisconsin Public Radio the great radio service it is. The one you count on for trustworthy news, statewide discussions, inspiring music, and laughter. As the year draws to a close, consider the value you get from Wisconsin Public Radio. Make your tax-deductible year-end gift right now. Go to WPR.org, and in minutes, you will have done a great thing. Thanks.
Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar, offering education about solar energy and the benefits for the new year, including battery power backup for home or business. AllEnergySolar.com/battery.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Matheson Memorial Library in Elkhorn will start its monthly matinees at Matheson with free movies and popcorn. January kicks off a classic remake of West Side Story. For more info, contact 262-723-2678.
We're on Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a look at what's happening in the news today. Dozens of people are dead after being stranded during a winter storm in Buffalo, which brought whiteout conditions to the area. Thousands of flights have been canceled across the country as well. The Russian military says it has shot down a Ukrainian drone approaching an airbase deep inside of Russia, the second time the airbase has been targeted this month. Russia's defense ministry says three servicemen were killed by debris at that airbase. We Energy says that homeowners can once again turn their thermostats back up, this after asking customers to lower the indoor temperature in their homes to 62 degrees on December 23rd. This happened after what the company calls a, quote, significant equipment failure in a pipeline which was delivering natural gas. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Some schools around the country face false reports of violence. 10 schools were targeted on the same day last month in Maine. These incidents, known as swatting, seem intended to draw an armed police response, and the fake threats bring real fear. Maine Public's Nicole Ogrisco reports.
November 15th started like any other day for Kristen DeForge, until she got a text that morning from her daughter, Jenna, who was inside Sanford High School and Regional Technical Center.
Jenna said, "Mom, there's a shooter in the high school and I'm locked in my classroom. And I think I went into panic mode."
Nearly a dozen nearby towns and federal agencies responded to the scene. Three air ambulances were on standby. Major hospitals closed their emergency rooms, preparing for the worst. Just 35 miles away, dispatchers received a similar call about an apparent active shooter at Portland High School. The school went into lockdown. Special education teacher Michael Brown says he couldn't quite hear the announcement, but knew something was wrong.
A few of my advisory students were sprinting down the hall with such a stressful look on their face and fear. And other teachers had come down from the first floor where they had witnessed the police come into the building and were just pushing kids into classrooms. And I knew right then it was serious.
More than 35 police officers swept the school, entering each classroom. Senior Eliza Stein was ushered into an unfamiliar office with a few others. She says they were checking social media posts on their phones and soon realized that Portland wasn't the only school that had been locked down.
Pretty quick, we figured out how to download the police app, and we were listening to the police radio. We were listening to the one in Sanford, like, in live time, and we were all just, like, silent.
But there was no shooter in Portland, Sanford, or any of the 8 other schools in Maine that received similar calls that morning. So far this school year, there have been at least 240 false reports of violence in schools around the country. Amy Klinger of the Educators School Safety Network tracks those incidents and says that's a nearly 600% increase in the last 4 years.
You can create chaos. You can undermine the institution. You can make people not trust the school, not want to send their kids to school, be afraid. I mean, people do it because it works. It clearly works.
There is no clear-cut motive behind the hoax calls, although an NPR analysis did find that schools in 28 states were apparently targeted earlier this year by the same individual. It's not clear if the hoax calls in Maine are part of that pattern, but the FBI and local authorities are investigating. For Kristen DeForge in Sanford, the experience didn't feel like a hoax. It's had a lingering impact on her and her daughter.
She saw police with assault rifles. She was led out of her classroom with her hands on her head. I mean, everything she saw and felt and smelt and every experience she had that day led her to believe there was a shooter in the school that day.
Swatting incidents have been a wake-up call for some schools, prompting them to revisit their safety plans. And Klinger warns these hoaxes have become so prevalent that all schools should prepare for one. For NPR News, I'm Nicole Ogrisco in Portland, Maine.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:49. Good morning. The latest news from NPR and WPR coming up just after 9 o'clock. As Wisconsin school districts face a shortage of nurses, an $8 million state grant is providing temporary relief. We'll hear more in our newscast about 10 minutes away on Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Gateway Radio Reading Service is for visually impaired listeners who would like to have newspapers and books read to them. In the Kenosha Racine area, easy-to-operate radios are available free of charge. Visit WGTD.org or call 564-3744.
Live. WPR is pleased to promote family-friendly fun. Find out more at WPR.org/events.
In sports, the Bucks lost to the Boston Celtics on Christmas Day. Final score 139-118. The Bucks now head to Chicago to take on the Bulls on Wednesday. The Packers' playoff hopes are still alive after the team beat the Miami Dolphins 26-20 on Sunday. The Packers will be back at Lambeau Field to take on the Vikings this upcoming Sunday. And the Wisconsin Badgers football team will be playing tomorrow night in the Guaranteed Rate Bowl against Oklahoma State. In weather today, slight snow in the southwestern portion of the state to start the day and dry across the rest of Wisconsin with daytime highs in the upper teens to low 20s across the state. Bitter cold in the overnight hours Tuesday with wind chills expected to hit 15 below in the northern portion of the state. That's before a warm front pushes through on Wednesday. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. 6 minutes and 54 seconds. That's how long it took for comedian Veer Das's life to turn upside down.
3 weeks, had 7 criminal complaints filed against me, being charged with sedition and defaming India on foreign soil. I was called a terrorist on 3 different news channels on the primetime news. That is an interesting conversation with your mother that evening.
His crime? He released a video titled, I Come From Two Indias. In it, he described the contradictions within his home country.
I come from an India that has the largest working population under 30 on the planet, but still listens to 75-year-old leaders with 150-year-old ideas. I come.
Back in India, the backlash against him was swift. In addition to the criminal complaints and being branded a terrorist, he was accused of not being a pure Indian. But this wasn't Das's first time being labeled an outsider. He's carried that label ever since he was a young boy growing up in Lagos, Nigeria.
Just when I'm nearing happiness in any country in the world, my parents can smell it and send me to another country. So just as I was nearing happiness in India, public school in Lagos, where I got my beaten every day because I was the guy from India. And just as soon as I had made friends in Lagos, off to private school in India, where I was the kid from Africa. I went to drama school in Galesburg, Illinois, which is the mecca of civilization, as we all know. It's just cornfield, college cornfield. So I was the kid from India then. And then I came in to try and work in Bollywood, where I was the guy from drama school.
Okay.
And now I work in America, where I'm the guy from Bollywood. So still very much an outsider. Has not changed.
Yeah, no matter what. Because I was thinking, if you're in India and you're from all these other places, people are saying that's the kid who thinks he's from India.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, and I think it takes you a while to figure out, you know, I definitely feel like I'm too Indian for the West, but I'm too Western for India.
Like, okay, check it out. I'm not so Indian that I would study to be a doctor. No. But like, I'm Indian enough where I would never use a white doctor. Sorry. Is this? I would let an Indian engineer treat me before a white doctor. I don't need curative medicine. I need cheap, efficient solutions now. Like, I perform in America, so I worry about being shot in America. I think you need gun control legislation immediately. But I'm also Indian. So I want to be friends with at least that one guy who has a gun.
So, you know, it's just that conflict, basically.
In his new Netflix special called Landing, Das recalls the night he was first labeled a terrorist in his country.
I was in New York for the Emmys for a show called Veer Das for India, for which I already had a legal case. By the time I walked the red carpet, I had 7 more. So I just had to fake it, right? I was on the red carpet and they were like, Veer, how does it feel to be in America right now? And I'm like, well, it's good to be outside of India. I'm not gonna lie. It's good to be traveling. Do you feel like people are excited for you back home? Well, they are not come. What are you gonna say if you win? Help? I don't know.
Did it feel almost like people in India ghosted you? Like a whole country ghosted a comedian?
No, I think that assigns blame to people, which I would never do. It felt like I let down my country. And I'll only ever assign blame to myself. So in that moment, you're not angry, you're ridden with guilt. And whether that's, you know, deserved guilt or undeserved guilt, you know, only retrospect will tell. But at that moment, you're just like, man, I feel sad. I think I let people down.
But in that situation, though, I mean, so you were seen then as someone in power, because obviously someone got so upset at your monologue and about what you said that it motivated them to lash out at you. So, I mean, you were the threat in that case, weren't you?
I don't think so. I think that's assigning too much. That's lionizing yourself, which I wouldn't do. You know, I think I touched a chord with people, and I don't think artists get to decide when you stumble into a conversation, when you create a conversation. It touched an undeniable chord with people, and it formed a basis for further interactions. But I do not think comedians are a threat to anybody or anything. I don't think laughter is a threat. I think it's a beautiful thing. You know, nobody's ever mad at laughter. It makes no sense to be mad at a comic. What you're mad at is the agreement, if you're mad at anything, you know.
And then what? You're supposed to go back to doing this again, like nothing ever happened. But it did. I mourned my whole career. I never thought I'd see you again. So now you and me, back in the same room together, this is an unplanned blessing that I could not be more grateful for in my heart.
Has performing changed for you since?
I think I had to just kind of go within myself for a while and make sure that it was at least 2 months or 3 months before I wrote my first joke. The tough thing is to never paint yourself as a victim or a hero, and also not be a comedian who, I think we all know sometimes comedians can get stuck in a feedback loop, right? Where they're reacting to their last special in this special, et cetera, et cetera. So to avoid that as well. So I set a rule when I was doing this special, which is your content may have become controversy, but controversy will never become your content. So if you've seen the special, you know, I just kind of say, a video went up, here's what happened immediately after, and here's why I was a moron at every level through dealing with it. And here's what's funny about that. And hopefully you resonate with stumbling, and this makes you feel better about who you are. So it didn't change anything but looking for the funny. It really drove me to look for the funny in a bad situation.
Tonight, New York City, I'd love to take you home. Do you want to go home with me? Yeah? Lovely. Your home. I might not be allowed back into mine.
Are you worried at all, Veer, that you'll always be the Indian comedian, not just comedian Veer Das? Does that matter to you?
I feel honored to be the Indian comedian. You know, at the end of the day, I feel like there's a vacancy for an authentic Indian perspective on the global circuit. There's 1.3 something billion people whose perspective isn't being talked about globally. And I want to be that perspective. So I'm happy to be the Indian comic Veer Das. And hopefully I'll make you laugh using the Indian accent as a perspective instead of just being a local punchline.
That's comedian Veer Das. His Netflix special is called Landing Veer. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, man.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
You've been listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:59. We've got news headlines coming your way at the top of the hour, then Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins.
What started with one experimental license more than 100 years ago is today Wisconsin Public Radio, with dozens of stations around the state and a comprehensive website at WPR.org. Members have made this remarkable journey possible. Thank you.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.